KRFP Moscow. It's right at 4 o'clock. This is the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Do a little bit of the weather here. Looks like more snow is projected for the next few days. Afternoon, 100% chance of showers, and that certainly seems to be the case. Tonight, about a 50% chance of rain or snow. Low, about 31. High tomorrow, about 39, a 50% chance of snow. A little bit cooler Thursday night, though. Low, 26, getting back into the more winter-like weather for spring. And high Friday, about 39 again, a 40% chance of snow. Low is 24 degrees on Friday night, and about a 20% chance of snow. Partly sunny and a high of 43 on Saturday. Saturday night, a low about 28, and mostly sunny, 44 on Sunday. So it looks like we're going into a cooling trend. We've got a good show for you today. First, I think I'll start off, though, with a little bit of Beau Soleil. I got into the Cajun mood there with some of the songs that were played there before. Here we have Chez Danouse McGee from Beau Soleil. C'est vraiment bien bon ça. Listening to KRFP Moscow. This is the Wild Clearwater Country Show. We're going to have a special guest here shortly. But I thought I should make an announcement about KRFP's fundraiser while I have the chance here. Oh, yes. Today, Wednesday, is the last day to purchase KRFP Real Radio dinner tickets. Book People's open till 6:30 p.m., and some tickets are available for purchase at the station this evening. Again, don't put it off too late, because if the disc jockey doesn't hear you knocking on the door, you might not be able to purchase those tickets. I've already got mine, so you should get yours as well at the station here at 114 East 3rd Street. You enter via the alleyway there between the antique store and to the west of there is that alleyway, and you head north. Tickets can be purchased on the website tonight as well. So you'll definitely want to do that. Now a little bit more music, and here we go. Some more Beau Soleil. Okay, and we're back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Lynn, can you hear me?
Yes, I do, Gary.
And you're coming in loud and clear. That is great. That is great. Well, we've got a special guest here today, Lynn Lahey. He's a resident on the Middle Fork of the Clearwater. You're right within the Wild and Scenic River Corridor, aren't you, Lynn?
And yes, and I've had property with scenic easements on it now for about, well, since 72. Yeah.
Wow, that's quite a period of time. So I wanted to talk today about a couple topics, and there, some people may think they're somewhat different, but I really think there is a connection here, and one is this environmental impact statement on the Army Corps of Engineers Lower Snake River Programmatic Sediment Management Plan, and that's quite a mouthful, but also some of the latest that's happening on the megaloads and what may be happening on the wild in the Wild and Scenic River Corridor, given the recent decision by Judge Windmill, and kind of where that's going from here. So, Lynn, I'm wondering which topic would you like to address first?
Well, like you said, Gary, they actually are related, and so it doesn't, you know, maybe the sediment one would get us a good start.
I think it does.
Because, of course, you know, the Port of Lewiston was hoping that the megaloads were going to be their salvation in terms of, you know, when facing a huge decline in the amount of freight being shipped out of the Port of Lewiston, you know, they were hoping that, you know, megaloads is going to solve that problem, but so far it hasn't. And in fact, the only real money they've made is because of the opposition to the megaloads that kept them there and forced Imperial Oil to disassemble those loads. And that's been really the only money they've made out of the deal. So anyway, they are connected, and so you know, it doesn't matter to me which we take on first.
Let's talk about the sediment and then tie that into sort of the megaloads. And one of the interesting things is in the environmental impact statement, it seems like the Army Corps has left out an analysis of basic economics. I wondered if you might want to address that and maybe some of the facets that they have basically excluded from their entire environmental impact statement.
Well, you know, when a number of folks from Moscow and upriver here and whatnot attended the open house the Army Corps held January 23rd in Lewiston, the the main questions that people were asking really were economic and socioeconomic. You know, what is this going to cost? What are the benefits, and what's the ratio of cost to benefits, and so forth? You know, they're proposing a plan, a 50-year plan, basically that involves principally dredging, although they also talk about raising the levee at Lewiston. They talk about putting in devices into the river, various weirs and dikes and so forth to try to keep the sediment moving and whatnot. So we're talking about a major project here, and they basically said, we don't have any cost data. We're not required to do that in an EIS, and they just wrote it off. And so there's all kinds of data out there that says that this is, you know, probably a very poor investment.
Yeah, I think so. A very, very poor investment is a good way to state it. In terms of, you know, the fiscal situation in the United States, I know you did a little digging, and I think you found out the importance, or lack thereof, of the freight miles, or the freight, the tonnage of freight shipped on this, what is it, 100 miles or so of the Lower Snake River, I guess more than 100 miles, but whatever that distance is, in the Lower Snake River barging system, and how much is that in terms of percent of what's shipped on rivers in the U.S.?
Well, again, the reason that question came up at that meeting was because people wanted to know where this river system, the Lower Snake, stood relative to potential prioritization of funds for the Army Corps. And, I mean, we know that it's not going to be business as usual, that the federal government is, you know, we're broke, we all know that. Major cuts coming down the pike, and well beyond just what's happening, you know, right now with the sequestration. And so certainly the Army Corps is going to get hit. And so the Corps answered, a spokesperson said, well, it really depends quite a bit on tonnage. That is, how much tonnage gets shipped on a given river. And, you know, how big a priority is, you know, maintenance and operations and projects and so forth. And so, yes, I did look into that. And first of all, you know, it's really common for the supporters of the four Snake River dams to talk about the Columbia Snake River system. And they toss out all kinds of figures about the Columbia Snake River system. For example, there's 55 million tons a year of freight travels on the Columbia Snake River system. Well, it turns out that the Snake River portion of that 55 million is 5 million. And, that's 5 million that goes through McNary Dam. And roughly half of what goes through McNary Dam comes down the Snake. So it doesn't take long to deduce that, you know, the Snake River only provides about 5% of the total amount of tonnage in the Columbia Snake River system. Most of that tonnage is from Portland to the sea and the sea into Portland. Secondly, then I looked at total ton miles on the Lower Snake, and this is really the most accurate figure because tons, you know, you don't know how far it traveled. Some river might be 50 miles long, some 500 miles, and so, you know, but when we look at ton miles, the amount of tons that got transported a mile, so to speak, then it turns out that the Lower Snake River accounts for 0.1% of national waterborne commerce, 0.1%. And so, you know, the Army Corps, I think, is going to have a difficult time assuring area residents that they are going to be able to secure the funds needed to continue this dredging operation every 3 or 4 years. And if they can't continue it, why continue it now?
That's a great question, Lynn. 0.1%, that's about, doing my math, if I'm correct, about 1/1,000th.
Yeah.
And that's not very much.
No, it's not.
In fact, it's hardly any. It's hardly any at all.
Well, and we have to recognize, too, of course, the trends going on here. I mean, that the freight at Port of Lewiston has been declining significantly since 2000. I mean, really, a lot has declined. And so, it's not like it's going to pop back up. In some areas, I mean, like, some commodities are no longer shipped or hardly at all. You know, for example, paper in the last 10 years has declined 81% paper shipments out of Clearwater Paper. Now, Clearwater Paper is humming and buzzing. I mean, they're doing very well. They're just not shipping by barge anymore. Container shipments are down by 77%. Wheat, their big product for commodities, it's down 36%. And they like to, of course, in the DEIS, the Army Corps says, well, you know, this is because of the recession of 2008-09, but these trends started, well before then. In fact, more than 50% of the decline occurred from 2000 to 2006, rather than, and all before the recession. The Corps likes, or the port likes to talk about how they support the lumber, the timber communities, and so forth. They haven't shipped a stick of timber in 5 years.
Wow. That's a telling, telling number, right there. One of the things I've been wondering too, when we're looking at this, aside from some of these very interesting economic issues, are some of the alternatives that are maybe out there, that are making the economics of shipping on, especially that Lower Snake and maybe even much of the Columbia, somewhat. A less desirable. I mean, some of the trains, haven't they been building some trains recently, some tracks recently, that or purchasing some tracks that would be used to haul, for example, grain to Puget Sound rather than Port of Portland or Astoria?
Yeah, this is definitely going on. They're called unit trains, and they're 110 car typically. And they run a little bigger cars, and they're one commodity. I mean, it's a train load of coal or a train load of wheat and whatever, and they go from point A basically to point B. I mean, they don't stop that much. Now these are going. They basically, that's what shut off a lot of the grain that used to come to the Port of Lewiston down Highway 12 out of Montana and North Dakota. That goes by unit train now. There's a big unit train installation at Ritzville, and they cited, the Ritzville folks cited significant savings in shipping by using the unit train over hauling to the ports. And now, most recently, the two farmer cooperatives on the Palouse have invested $17 million in a new unit train loading facility called the McCoy Loader, which is between Rosalia and Oaksdale. And they feel it'll be operational by this fall for wheat harvest, and it's going to significantly increase the amount of grain going off the Palouse country by rail instead of coming to the port. So these, and I find it interesting that farmer cooperatives are investing in this. So that tells you something. And, of course, I keep hearing how barge transportation is so much cheaper, and I'm trying to think, well, gee, I mean, if it's so much cheaper, why has it declined 45% in the last 10 years? You know, I guess maybe people are happy to spend more money. I don't know.
I
don't think farmers I know don't look at it that way.
I don't know any farmers that would look at it that way either, and as somebody that dabbles in the profession myself, and I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I certainly couldn't imagine anyone doing it just to pay more. I think they're probably getting a better deal, which is interesting that even when it's subsidized barging, it may not be as good as trains, and maybe even from an energy perspective. I think you've looked into that as well, Lynn, about the overall energy costs of barging on the lower Snake versus, let's say, rail?
Well, see, there are several what shall we call them, pieces of misinformation, okay? Somebody might just, you know, call them propaganda, or somebody might call them lies. But the industry likes to, the barging industry and the ports like to put out, you know, this data, and they constantly claim that for example, the fuel efficiency of a barge is greater than rail. And they cite old data, and even though when they know that it's been updated, they cite the old data, and they show that, you know, it's more fuel efficient to ship by barge. And because it's more fuel efficient, then it's less polluting because they claim they burn less fuel. Well, there are all sorts of holes in that argument, which I won't get into at great length, but the major study that was done on that very issue was done by Ken Cassavant, who is from WSU. He's the head of the Freight Transportation Institute there at WSU. I mean, certainly considered one of the most knowledgeable people about this topic there is, you know, anywhere. And Trent Ball is the University of Washington professor. And those two did a significant study. They did one in 1999, and which showed that the difference between rail and barge was not much difference. And so some of the folks who support the dams on the Snake River said, well, that's because you use national fuel efficiency data and not regional data. And so Ball and Cassavant said, okay, we'll redo the study and we'll use regional efficiency data, efficiency coefficients. And they did. And this was an extensive study. I mean, they had GPS units on grain trucks and figuring out how far grain trucks travel to get to the port versus to get to rail. And I mean, it was very detailed and extensive. And the conclusion of it, and this was in 2002, the conclusion was that if you shut down navigation, commercial navigation on this lower Snake River, you would emit less pollution and use less energy.
Wow, what a conclusion. So,
and of course, you know, that you know, the DEIS doesn't even touch that. They don't even deal with that issue in any form. And that's you know, one of the things they're going to be faced with, I think, in terms of people who make comments and point out that, you know, and by the way, that study was 2002, and since then, rail, that was before we had many unit trains operating, and so since that time, rail has gotten increasingly efficient in terms of fuel and energy use, BTUs and so forth, and so if they were to do that study again, I think we could be pretty confident that the difference would be even greater.
That's an astounding revelation, because the general belief out there among many members of the public is that indeed water transportation is cheaper and more efficient, but that isn't always the case, especially on a river that maybe isn't that big like the lower Snake in terms of having a lot of water and a lot of depth for barge transportation. So I find that absolutely fascinating. So there are other issues, I think, as well. Sediment dredging tends to be a really big concern of the EIS, yet in terms of how much sediment they're actually going to remove, it makes me sort of scratch my head. I've looked at some of the numbers from the draft environmental impact statement, and I know you have, and I wonder why are they doing it when it seems to be they're way behind the eight ball in terms of removing sediment, and will be even if they dredge a lot.
Well, there when I first did my calculations and looking at their data, I figured out that if we looked at the last 20 years, they and annualized the amount of, you know, dredging that needed to be done, it came out to about 177,000 cubic yards a year. And their figures, then I later found in the appendix, this, remember this document, this DEIS is 1,500 pages. And so, you know, anyway, but later I found out that they you know, estimated that the amount of dredging that, that had been done at 176,000. So we're pretty much in agreement there. And so that's annualized for every year. However, they also note in the DEIS that the amount of forest fires occurring in the watershed that feeds the confluence and the Snake has grown, I mean, almost exponentially. I mean, it is just, I mean, over the last 30 years, when you look at a graph of each of those decades, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and, the first decade of the century, much greater forest fire activity, I mean, like four times as much. And we know that, and the Corps knows, and, you know, states that forest fires, burned land is one of the major contributors to sediment. So they're saying, you know, we just may be getting more sediment in the future. Then they have various studies that show that, this is going to be the case due to climate change. One researcher, for example, that they hired to look at this, said that the amount of sediment reaching the confluence could be as high as 10 times the historical amount. 10 times.
10 times, that's...
Now, you know, so let's say it's not 10 times. Let's say it's not even 5 times. Let's say, oh my gosh, let's imagine it's twice.
Twice, okay.
Now, we're looking at a lot of dredging. But here's what I find fascinating. The Corps says, well, we look at the last 20 years, and we've had, it's actually, their estimate is 79 point something or other, and so they'd round it off and say about 80 million cubic yards have reached the confluence. And a lot of that doesn't get deposited there. I mean, I should point that out. A lot of it moves on downstream, okay? So it's not like, because I mean, initially I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, they'd have to dredge, you know, every year, so to speak. But a lot of it moves on down into deeper waters. So, but anyway, I found it interesting. They said, you know, historically, last 34 years, about 80 million cubic yards have arrived at the confluence. Now, remember, they, you know, noted the forest fires. They predicted, you know, greater amounts of sediment in the future. So they say, and we expect over the next 50 years, 83 million cubic yards.
What, no,
over 50 years instead of 34 years.
Well,
I got out my 8th grade math and said, that doesn't seem right. They're projecting a 25% decrease in sediment, because if you looked at the same amount of sediment that arrived the last 34 years and looked at it over 50 years, it would come to 111 cubic yards, and they're projecting 83 million cubic yards. So it's a little hard to understand some of their work on the DEIS.
And hard to understand the math behind it. I guess it's really not hard.
I think it's called cooking the books.
Yes, exactly. It's when they admit that they're going to have an increase in sediment, yet they show a decrease in their documents.
Right, right.
I think there's a serious problem.
Yes, I do too. There are a lot of serious problems with the draft environmental impact statement. I mean, a lot of serious problems.
May I interrupt?
Yeah, Borg.
Is it Gary on the line?
Yes, it is. We're on the radio.
Hi, Borg.
And this is Borg Hendrickson.
Join us, you megalod monster. You?
Yes, the person who has informed many of the listeners of KRFP about the megalodes and what's happening. So, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Good to have you with us. So
we're going to get into megalodesborg.
We are. In fact, we're going to start segueing
just
fairly.
Kind of wrapping up the EIS.
We're wrapping up the environmental impact statement. One of the things that I would encourage listeners to do, if they are interested in this topic, there is information that's posted on the web on several organizational websites, and they could comment. And it tells you how to comment, because the comments are due, Lynn, I believe, the 26th of March.
That's correct.
So that's next Tuesday. So you don't, is that Tuesday the 26th? I believe that's right. Tuesday is the 26th. So you don't have a lot of time. You have 6 days, but there's a wealth of information on the web. I know that Lynn Lahey here has done a lot of work on it and has helped people formulate some of the questions and some of the points that they could make. But if you want to comment, you could visit the websites. Idaho Rivers United has information on their website. Save Our Wild Salmon does. Friends of the Clearwater, that's the organization that I work for, has some on its website as well. It's, our website is www.friendsoftheclearwater.org. And Idaho Rivers United, I believe that's IRU.org, isn't that? Or IdahoRivers.org. Again, you can find them on the website. There's a lot of information out there, and that will help you in writing your comments. And you can submit them electronically to the Army Corps. They have a form and whatnot as a way to do those kind of comments. So I would encourage everyone to comment on this draft environmental impact statement and point out some of these flaws that we've been talking about in it. It really does not do justice to either the Lower Snake River or the citizens of the U.S., especially given many of the concerns surrounding an aging infrastructure, the fact that, as you said, Lynn, 0.1% of the inland freight is shipped. Waterborne commerce in the U.S. Is on the Lower Snake River. So there are some serious issues here to address. I wonder if you would have talked a little bit about some of the alternatives they didn't look at, and also this whole idea of this flood control. And that's sort of a big topic in and of itself, about what may or may not happen with or without dredging, or even with dredging, I guess I should say.
Well, first of all, you raised the issue of alternatives. You know, NEPA requires, for one thing, a no-action alternative. And they don't have any no-action alternative. Their no-action alternative is to keep the channel functional. And because they... And so they said if they didn't dredge, they'd start raising the pool. They have 5 more feet to the top of the dam, and they would keep raising it, even though that violates the biop agreement relative to salmon. They would keep raising it to keep the water high enough for the channel until finally they said they'd have to dredge anyway. Well, that's simply not a no-action alternative. I mean, if the Forest Service wants to do a clear cut and they say, you know, there's a no-action alternative, the no-action alternative isn't, well, we're going to continue the practice of getting out the cut to keep the mills operating.
No, no.
And that's not a no action. You know?
No.
And so first of all, they have no action. They have 6 other alternatives, but they're really only 2. They combine them here and there. And one is to just dredge, and the other one is their full toolbox, which is to dredge and build, you know, dikes and weirs and all sorts of other things. You know, in the river. And so they fail completely to address the issue of what if we just closed Port Lewiston? I mean, they can't close the Port Lewiston, but, you know, if they didn't dredge the channel, at some point the marine operations of the port would have to cease. Well, I mean, you know, that's an alternative. I mean, it probably beats saving maybe, you know, $500,000 in shipper cost, or even $1 million, at a cost of $2 million of taxpayer subsidy to dredge on an annualized basis every year. And so that's, you know, they don't look at that alternative. They don't look at the alternative of doing away with the navigation on the Lower Snake. And that's liable to happen at some point, anyway, because the system, the Army Corps is so extended all over the Mississippi. I mean, they're way overextended. They can't begin with their current budget to maintain what they've got. So, you know, that's just a couple of comments on alternatives. I mean, they simply don't take a serious look at other alternatives for managing sediment, and that's what they're supposed to be doing.
Okay. Well, Lynn, do you have any sort of wrap-up in terms of this environmental impact statement?
Well, I just think that people are looking at this from a number of perspectives, and one of the key ones is the economics of it, and I think it's going to raise a whole bunch of questions about the economic viability of river transport on the Lower Snake.
Okay. Well, again, I would encourage everyone to write or send in your comments now in the electronic era. We are able to send letters very quickly. Visit some of those websites, organizations like Idaho Rivers United or Save Our Wild Salmon or Friends of the Clearwater. I have information on their websites about this, and please visit them. Lynn,
I was going to say too, Gary, some of that information includes, you know, like up to 10 points that a person could, you know, say, number three, I'd really like to emphasize, and number six, and so forth, and they could pick and choose and you know, comprise compose a letter that the research has been done for them. They just need to craft it in their own language.
That's right, and it's right there on the on those websites. And I know that, Borg, you have a website. Is that going to be information going to be on it, or is your website going to be continue to be dedicated to the issue of the megaloads?
Apparently she dropped off.
Okay.
She is focused. I mean, you know, that website is
focused on the megaloads. That's what I thought. So visiting one of these other organizations' sites, and Idaho Rivers United, Save Our Wild Salmon, Friends of the Clearwater, and I guess other organizations, Idaho Chapter of the Sierra Club, well, I believe has a website.
Yes, they do.
And they have some information.
These organizations are sending out, you know, calls for action to members, I know.
Mm-hmm. So I would encourage the listeners here to do that as well. And I guess we could probably segue into this megaload issue, Lynn. I think it's quite a big one. And it's sometimes there are these ups and downs. I wonder if you could explain a little bit the windmill decision and then sort of the current state of affairs and what's happening and sort of why is it happening and kind of where the... I guess what the future may hold and what citizens could do. I guess there's also action that citizens can take on this as well.
Yes, there is, definitely. Borg, I think you're back on, right? No, maybe not. Anyway, well, because Borg has been sending out some material here lately. Well, first of all, the windmill decision, of course, basically eliminated the Forest Service's argument that they had no jurisdiction over Highway 12 in terms of megaloads. It's very clear now, the law, I mean, the judge said, yes, the Forest Service has jurisdiction, and in fact, they have responsibilities in terms of Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, the Northwest Passage Scenic Byway Corridor Management Plan, the Nez Perce Trail, historic trail, the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail. He listed all kinds of laws like six major ones, that give the Forest Service jurisdiction to deal with megaloads on Highway 12. Secondly, the Nez Perce Tribe filed an amicus brief in this case, which was pretty interesting, and they pointed out that not all of Highway 12 is even in the original easement right-of-way deed that went to the Idaho Transportation Department. So there are some sections of Highway 12 that have never been transferred to ITD at all. And so that's brewing out there as to, you know, they're not sure what they're going to do about that. And it raises NEPA questions and issues, for example. And so, you know, that's kind of that's, you know, the background. Then we have Mr. Brazell, the supervisor of Clearwater National Forest, now NEZ First Clearwater National Forest, last week in Moscow, or 2 weeks ago, when, recently anyway, saying that he thought the whole idea of managing megaloads in Highway 12 was stupid. And I found it very interesting. This is a quote out of the newspaper, at least. I wasn't at the meeting. I think you were.
I was at the meeting, and he did say that.
But he also said, well, if it gets into the courts, then we can't control it.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite a statement. We can't control it. It's like, you know, if the people go to the court and get a court decision, Forest Service loses control, and ITD loses
control.
Woo, I thought that was, you know, a real telling statement. Anyway, so right now we have reason to think that ITD is just going to issue permits, just business as usual. Anybody who wants one, just stand up, pay your money, and you've got a megaload permit to haul over 12. The Forest Service is probably not going to do anything. And until, and Mr. Brazell at that meeting in Moscow was quoted as saying that he was getting pressure from the state, that would be ITD. And so right now, at least I know that Borg is working on getting people to develop some pressure from citizens, including those who live along the route and others who've been actively engaged in this megaload battle. And so I think people are going to be writing letters to Mr. Brazell, and probably some citizens are going to request a meeting with Mr. Brazell. And there'll probably be some media, and I know they're Friends of the Clearwater is stepping up their public records requests. To
that is right.
ITD. And so we're just going to launch, I guess, you know, a bit of a new offensive here. We thought we had squared this thing away with that ruling from Judge Windmill, but looks like we have some more legwork to do.
It certainly seems that way. It is disappointing to me that Mr. Brazell did call it stupid. I was a little surprised. I also thought I heard him say, and I could be wrong about this, but I thought he said or implied that the National Environmental Policy Act doesn't work, even though they use it every day, and it does. So I wasn't sure exactly what he was saying during part of that meeting. It was a very interesting and it was a lively meeting. It wasn't, I don't think, it wasn't an angry meeting, but it was lively because people were asking some hard questions. And now the onus is back on the Forest Service to do something. Now, he said in a letter with, I believe, the Lolo Forest Supervisor, that they were not pleased. The Forest Service was not pleased about these megaloads, but they could do nothing. Now that they can do something, it seems like they have an obligation to do something.
Yeah, it's very interesting that, I mean, his letter about the megaloads on Highway 12 was a key element in the Idaho Rivers United versus Forest Service case. And you know, he, as Forest Supervisor, said he had great concerns about megaloads and that they would, you know, be a problem for traffic. They would be, you know, fail to uphold the aesthetic values of the corridor and on. I mean, he wrote a lengthy letter citing the many problems and issues that megaload traffic on Highway 12 through the Wild and Scenic River Corridor would create. And so, but he, and then the last paragraph says, but unfortunately, I just have no power. I have no jurisdiction in this matter. Well, he does have jurisdiction, and that's the law. And in fact, Judge Windmill said that the Forest Service acted unlawfully in failing to address this issue. They, in other words, the Forest Service broke the law. And so I think the citizens are going to have to make that point very clear. And we are also will be, you know, the folks that work on this all the time will be communicating very soon with trucking companies and manufacturers of equipment and so forth, saying you need to be aware of this law, I mean, of this decision from in federal court, and that this has implications, very definite implications, for future megalodes, and that you're if you're planning on coming here with megalodes, you're going to be met with resistance.
Wow. Yeah, that's exactly, I think, what needs to happen. The Forest Service needs to take responsibility. I mean, that's the job of that agency, and the judge has said so, and now they need to do something, and I think people can help the Forest Service make the right decision by communicating with the Forest Service. So, Lynn, what is the website that people can contact Fighting Goliath, the citizens? And this is more of a network. It's not an organization per se, but it's a, I guess you would, am I stating it correctly, Lynn? It's a network of people?
Well, it's you know, a group of people. First mm-hmm. of all, that, I mean, the group is called the Rural People of Highway 12, and so there's a core group of people in the Upper Clearwater Valley that live, you know, near and next to and, you know, et cetera, Highway 12, and own property and have scenic easements along the corridor and frequent users and so forth. So that's the kind of core group. But then it is a network beyond that, and the network includes literally probably thousands of people because it includes a lot of organizations. I mean, the group of, you know, the list of organizations that are involved in this fight is, 30 or 40 organizations long, and so when something goes out to the network, it goes to a lot of people, and so we really don't know how many people are in the network, but, and Borg hasn't been keeping the website so up to date because, you know, we thought we had this thing taken care of, everything was, you know, with the, especially with the federal decision and so forth, but she has a major communication network that she sends things out to regularly. I mean, like, you know, every week or 10 days or when there are key developments. And so anybody, you know, you can access the website, and then if you just, you know, click on you know, if you want to be included in her network, then just, you know, go to the website, and it'll tell you, you know, what to do. The website is www.fightinggoliath.org, O-R-G. Fighting Goliath, and that's kind of easy to remember in this battle.
Yes, it is, because it started out, of course, with ExxonMobil. I believe that's about the richest company in the world, or one of the largest, anyway.
Well, and the folks that, you know, have been so involved in this, and I know a lot of, you know, them are from Moscow, mm-hmm. You know, as well, and the folks who've been involved in this should take some note, I guess, of a recent announcement by Imperial Oil, that's a subsidiary of Exxon, that brought the 34 modules to Lewiston in October 2010. And they, the key spokesman, Pius Rollheiser, recently told the Calgary Herald that the Kearl Oil Project, for which that equipment and plus, you know, a total of 207 modules they had planned to bring up Highway 12, he said that the Kearl Oil Project was behind schedule, and probably, you know, he didn't say this, but, I mean, they're talking about May now, so that puts them behind schedule by 6 months, and it was over budget by $2 billion, that's with a B.
With a B? Wow.
Billion dollars, and that he attributed much of this cost overrun to difficulties they had getting their equipment shipped through Idaho and Montana.
Well, it sounds like citizens are doing what citizens ought to be doing in a democracy or a democratic republic, and exercising
right.
Their rights.
It was interesting also that about 3 days or 4 days later, there was another news article that said that the CEO of Imperial Oil was, quote-unquote, stepping down. So I guess there are consequences for, you know, even with Exxon, of screwing up by a figure of $2
billion. Wow. Wow. Well, that is a lot of money by any standard. Maybe even would have a slight dent, but still a dent of some. some significance in the U.S.'s budget deficit. So a little bit anyway, I guess. Well, Lynn, www.fightinggoliath.org. People, if they want to become involved in this megaload issue, in a sense, we may be in one of the final, I would like to think at least, we're in one of the final stretches of this process, and hopefully we can come out with a good solid win here. We've got some momentum behind us, although we can't take it for granted because, again, the Forest Service supervisor called it stupid, the decision that went against the Forest Service, or at least stupid the idea that the Forest Service should do anything about these megaloads, in spite of the fact he himself said he did not like them in an earlier letter. So it looks like we may be in seeing light at the end of the tunnel. At least I would hope so.
I would hope so, too. It's been a three-year battle and for a lot of people, and so I would really hope so, too. But, I think people are really committed on this. I mean, the people I know, the organizations I know, like Friends of the Clearwater, like Idaho Rivers United, very committed on this, and we've got support throughout the country. And so I guess that, we're not going away.
No, we're not. We are residents of north central Idaho, whether we live right along the Clearwater River, or the Upper Clearwater, or whether some of us that may live elsewhere, we're all residents, and most residents use Highway 12 during either their daily commutes or, for recreation purposes or just, for other reasons.
Yeah, that river will be starting to rise pretty soon, and it's going to be time to hit the locks off.
That is right. Well, Lynn, I really want to thank you for taking the time to join us on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Lynn, I think you really epitomize what a citizen should be, and I want to thank you for all your great work as a citizen and in trying to hold our government agencies accountable to the public.
Well, it gets discouraging once in a while, but it's worth doing. We all have our various roles to play, and fortunately I have the time right now to devote to the DEIS, and Borg is active with the megaloads, and so we're going to keep our voices out there.
Well, again, thank you very much for all that you do, and also to your wife, Borg Hendrickson, for her great work in fighting megaloads.
Good talking with you, Gary.
Good, and thank you so much. And you're listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. We just concluded an interview with Lynn Lahey, a local resident along the Middle Fork of the Clearwater and right along Highway 12, and their lives have been very much affected by these monster megaloads. And they're also concerned about the issues of sediment in the Lower Snake River, and how the Army Corps of Engineers is trying to deal with that issue, realizing that maybe it just doesn't make sense anymore to continue with the farce that we can and should use the Lower Snake River as a major commerce artery when there are cheaper and even more fuel-efficient options available. Well, a couple of quick announcements before we conclude the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Wanted to announce that the Great Old Broads for Wilderness, get into the Wild Spring Meeting and Potluck, Tuesday, March 26th, 2013, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Fisk Room of the 1912 Center. All are welcome. You don't have to be a Great Old Broad. Please bring a soup, salad, or cookies to share. Come learn about their Kelly Creek and North Fork Clearwater summer trips and summer service project opportunities. They will also be screening, and I think this would be a wonderful see, A Sense of Wonder, a Rachel Carson documentary. I think this is definitely worth going to see. If you have questions or contact, You can go to their website, greatoldbroads.org. And they're a national organization. They have local chapters. This is a local chapter. And if you have questions, contact Ashley hyphen Lipscomb, Lipscomb, at gmail.com. Again, Ashley, Ashley, period Lipscomb. Boy, I need my glasses. Period Lipscomb at gmail.com. Again, Ashley, period Lipscomb at gmail.com. If you have a question about this specific event. So that ought to be a really, really, really good time. I also want to let everyone know that today, Wednesday, the 20th, this is the last day to purchase KRFP Real Radio dinner tickets. And I've got mine purchased already, and I hope you do as well. But if you don't, this is your last chance. Book People's open until 6:30 p.m. today. Again, you have until 6:30 p.m. And some tickets, there's a few tickets, are available for purchase at the station this evening at 114 East 3rd Street. You have to enter via the alley. It's just the alleyway that goes north between Main Street and Washington. Again, if you're on the north side of 3rd Street, go down that alley, and there's a door off to your right, away down there. Tickets can be purchased on the website tonight as well. So that might be the best way. Please, 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 please come to this great fundraising event. There will be a silent auction, and there's going to be a lot of really, really, really good food. Well, I'm going to take a very quick break here, play a little more music, but then come back and do the weather. So here we go with a little more Beau Soleil. Back to Wild Clearwater Country Show. Let's do the weather and then move on to Between the Lines. Well, it looks like this late afternoon, the chance of precipitation has decreased from 100% earlier this afternoon, which we all experienced, and what a storm that was, to about 50%. Tonight, there's about a 50% chance of rain or snow. The high today was projected to be about 53. Right now, it's about 43 degrees at the Moscow Pullman Airport. Tonight's low is projected to be about 31 degrees. Tomorrow, about 50% chance of snow, just under 40 degrees, 39 for the high is the projection. Low about 26. So that's getting more wintry type weather. Friday, a high of about 39 again, about a 40% chance of snow. And Friday night, about a 20% chance of snow. Low about 24. For the weekend, partly sunny, about a high of 43, low about 28. Again, a partly cloudy night, and mostly sunny on Sunday, high about 44. Now we go to Between the Lines. You're listening to KRFP Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and HyperSpud Sports, specializing in equipment for outdoor adventures. HyperSpud Sports is located at 402 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, call 208-883-1150 or visit hyperspud.com.
KRFP is also supported by
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Yo, this is the original Daddy Cool Squadron, KRFP Moscow. Yeah, let's go.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who talks about his campaign to increase the federal minimum wage. Paul Corbett Brown and Elise Keaton of the Keeper of the Mountains Foundation